Chapter 26 The Sparrows Are Flying 1 When Liz closed the door and left the two men alone, Thad opened his notebook and looked at the blank page for a moment. Then he picked up one of the sharpened barrel pencils.
"I'm going to start with the cake," he said to Stark.
"Yes," Stark said. A kind of longing eagerness filled his face.
"That's right."
Thad poised the pencil over the blank page. This was the moment that was always the best, just before the first stroke. This was surgery of a kind, and in the end the patient almost always died, but you did it anyway. You had to, because it was what you were made for. Only that. Just remember, he thought. Remember what you're doing. But a part of him, the part that really wanted to write Steel Machine, protested. Thad bent forward and began to fill up the empty space. Steel Machine by George Stark. Chapter 1 The Wedding. Alexis Machine was rarely whimsical, and for him to have a whimsical thought in such a situation as this was something which had never happened before. Yet it occurred to him. Of all the people on Earth, what, 5 billion of them? I'm the only one who is currently standing inside a moving wedding cake with a Heckler & Koch 223 semi-automatic weapon in my hands. He had never been so shut up in a place. The air had gotten bad almost at once, but he could not have drawn a deep breath in any case. The Trojan cake's frosting was real, but beneath it was nothing but a thin layer of a gypsum product called Nartex, a kind of high-class cardboard. If he filled his chest, the bride and groom standing on top of the cake's top tier would probably topple. Surely the icing would crack, and... He wrote for nearly 40 minutes, picking up speed as he went along, his mind gradually filling up with the sights and sounds of the wedding party, which would end with such a bang. Finally, he put the pencil down. He had written it blunt.
"Give me a cigarette," he said.
Stark raised his eyebrows.
"Yes," Thad said.
There was a pack of Pall Malls lying on the desk. Stark shook one out, and Thad took it. The cigarette felt strange between his lips after so many years. Too big, somehow. But it felt good. It felt right. Stark scratched a match and held it out to Thad, who inhaled deeply. The smoke bit his lungs in its old, merciless, necessary way. He felt immediately woozy, but he didn't mind the feeling at all. "Now I need a drink," he thought. "And if this ends with me still alive and standing up, that's the first thing I'm going to have."
"I thought you quit," Stark said.
Thad nodded. "Me too. What can I say, George? I was wrong." He took another deep drag and feathered smoke out through his nostrils. He turned his notebook toward Stark.
"Your turn," he said.
Stark leaned over the notebook and read the last paragraph Thad had written. There was really no need to read more. They both knew how this story went. Back in the house, Jack Rangeley and Tony Westerman were in the kitchen, and Rollick should be upstairs now. All three of them were armed with Steyr AUG semi-automatics, the only good machine gun made in America. And even if some of the bodyguards masquerading as guests were very fast, the three of them should be able to lay down a firestorm more than adequate to cover their retreat. "Just let me out of this cake," Machine thought. "That's all I ask." Stark lit a Pall Mall himself, picked up one of his barrels, opened his own notebook, and then paused. He looked at Thad with naked honesty.
"I'm scared, Hoss," he said.
And Thad felt a great wave of sympathy for Stark, in spite of everything he knew. "Scared. Yes, of course you are," he thought. "Only the ones just starting out, the kids, aren't scared. The years go by and the words on the page don't get any darker, but the white space sure does get whiter."
"Scared? You'd be crazier than you are if you weren't."
"I know," he said, "and you know what it comes down to. The only way to do it is to do it." Stark nodded and bent over his notebook. Twice more he checked back at the last paragraph Thad had written, and then he began to write. The words formed themselves with agonized slowness in Thad's mind. machine had never wondered, a long pause, then all in a burst, what it would be like to have asthma, but if anyone ever asked him after this, a shorter pause, he would remember the Scaretti job. He read over what he had written, then looked at Thad unbelievingly. Thad nodded. It makes sense, George. He fingered the corner of his mouth, which suddenly stung, and felt a fresh sore breaking there. He looked at Stark and saw that a similar sore had disappeared from the corner of Stark's mouth. It's happening. It's really happening. Go for it, George, he said. Knock the hell out of it. But Stark had already bent over his notebook again, and now he was writing faster. 2. Stark wrote for almost half an hour, and at last he put the pencil down with a little gasp of satisfaction.
It's good, he said in a low, gloating voice. It's just as good as can be.
Thad picked up the notebook and began to read, and unlike Stark, he read the whole thing. What he was looking for began to show up on the third page of the 9 Stark had written. Machine heard scraping sounds and stiffened, hands tightening on the Heckler and Sparrow, and then understood what they were doing. The guests, some 200 of them, gathered at the long tables under the huge blue and yellow striped marquee, were pushing their folding Sparrows back along the boards which had been laid to protect the lawn from the punctuation of the women's high-heeled Sparrows. The guests were giving the Sparrow cake a fucking standing ovation. He doesn't know, Thad thought. He's writing the word Sparrows over and over again, and he doesn't have the slightest fucking idea. Overhead, he heard them moving restlessly back and forth, and the twins had looked up several times before falling asleep, so he knew they had noticed it too. Not George, though. For George, the Sparrows did not exist. Thad went back to the manuscript. The word began to creep in more and more frequently, and by the last paragraph, the whole phrase had begun to show up. Machine found out later that the Sparrows were flying, and the only people on his hand-picked string that really were his Sparrows were Jack Rangeley and Lester Rollick. All the others, Sparrows he had flown with for 10 years, were all in on it. Sparrows. And they started flying even before Machine shouted into his Sparrow talkie.
Well? Stark asked when Thad put his manuscript down. What do you think?
I think it's fine, Thad said. But you knew that, didn't you?
Yes, but I wanted to hear you say it, Hoss.
I also think you're looking much better. Which was true. While George had been lost in the fuming, violent world of Alexis Machine, he had begun to heal. The sores were disappearing. The broken, decaying skin was growing pink again. The edges of this fresh skin were reaching across the healing sores toward each other, in some cases already knitting together. Eyebrows which had disappeared into a soup of rotting flesh were reappearing. The trickles of pus which had turned the collar of Stark's shirt an ugly sodden yellow were drying. Thad reached up with his left hand and touched the sore which was beginning to erupt on his own left temple, and held the pads of his fingers in front of his eyes for a moment. They were wet. He reached up again and touched his forehead. The skin was smooth. The small white scar, souvenir of the operation which had been performed on him in the year when his real life began, was gone. One end of the teeter-totter goes up, the other end has to come down. Just another law of nature, baby. Just another law of nature. Was it dark outside yet? Thad supposed it must be, dark or damned near. He looked at his watch, but there was no help there. It had stopped at 4:45. The time didn't matter. He would have to do it soon. Stark smashed a cigarette out in the overflowing ashtray.
You want to go on or take a break?
Why don't you go on? Thad said. I think you can.
Yeah, Stark said.
He was not looking at Thad. He had eyes only for the words. The words. The words. He ran a hand through his blonde hair, which was becoming lustrous again.
I think I can, too. In fact, I know I can.
He began to scribble again. He looked up briefly when Thad got out of his chair and went to the pencil sharpener, then looked back down. Thad sharpened one of the barrels to a razor point, and as he turned back, he took the bird call Raleigh had given him out of his pocket. He closed it in his hand and sat down again, looking at the notebook in front of him. This was it. This was the time. He knew it as well and as truly as he knew the shape of his own face under his hand. The only question left was whether or not he had the guts to try it. Part of him did not want to. A part of him still lusted after the book. But he was surprised to find that feeling was not as strong as it had been when Liz and Alan left the study. And he supposed he knew why. A separation was taking place. A kind of obscene birth. It wasn't his book anymore. Alexis Machine was with the person who had owned him from the start. Still holding the bird call cupped tightly in his left hand, Thad bent over his own notebook. "I am the bringer," he wrote. Overhead, the restless shifting of the birds stopped. "I am the knower," he wrote. The whole world seemed to still, to listen. "I am the owner." He stopped and glanced at his sleeping children. "Five more words," he thought. "Just five more." And he discovered he wanted to write them more than any words he had ever written in his life. He wanted to write stories, but more than that, more than he wanted the lovely visions that third eye sometimes presented, he wanted to be free. Five more words. He raised his left hand to his mouth and gripped the bird call in his lips like a cigar. "Don't look up now, George. Don't look up. Don't look out of the world you're making. Not now. Please, dear God, don't let him look out into the world of real things now." On the blank sheet in front of him, he wrote the word "Psychopomps" in cold capital letters. He circled it. He drew an arrow below it, and below the arrow he wrote, "The sparrows are flying." Outside, a wind began to blow, only it was no wind. It was the ruffling of millions of feathers, and it was inside Thad's head. Suddenly, that third eye opened in his mind, opened wider than it ever had before. And he saw Bergenfield, New Jersey, the empty houses, the empty streets, the mild spring sky. He saw the sparrows everywhere, more than there had ever been before. The world he had grown up in had become a vast aviary. Only it wasn't Bergenfield. It was Ennsville. Stark quit writing. His eyes widened with sudden belated alarm. Thad drew in a deep breath and blew. The bird call Raleigh de Lesseps had given him uttered a strange, squealing note. "Thad? What are you doing? What are you doing?" Stark snatched for the bird call. Before he could touch it, there was a bang and it split open in Thad's mouth, cutting his lips. The sound woke the twins. Wendy began to cry. Outside, the rustle of the sparrows rose to a roar. They were flying. 3. Liz had started for the stairs when she heard Wendy begin to cry. Alan stood where he was for a moment, transfixed by what he saw outside. The land, the trees, the lake, the sky, they were all blotted out. The sparrows rose in a great wavering curtain, darkening the window from top to bottom and side to side. As the first small bodies began to thud into the reinforced glass, Alan's paralysis broke. "Liz!" he screamed. "Liz, down!" But she wasn't going to get down. Her baby was crying, and that was all she could think about. Alan sprinted across the room toward her, employing that almost eerie speed which was his own secret, and tackled her just as the entire window wall blew inward under the weight of 20,000 sparrows. 20,000 more followed them, and 20,000 more, and 20,000 more. In a moment the living room was filled with them. They were everywhere. Alan threw himself on top of Liz and pulled her under the couch. The world was filled with the shrill cheeping of sparrows. Now they could hear the other windows breaking, all the windows. The house rattled with the thuds of tiny suicide bombers. Alan looked out and saw a world that was nothing but brown-black movement. Smoke detectors began to go off as birds crashed into them. Somewhere there was a monstrous crash as the TV screen exploded, clatters as pictures on the walls fell, a series of metallic xylophone bonks as sparrows struck the pots hanging on the wall by the stove and knocked them to the floor. And still he could hear the babies crying and Liz screaming,
"Let me go! My babies! Let me go! I have to get my babies!"
She squirmed halfway out from beneath him, and her upper body was immediately covered with sparrows. They caught in her hair and fluttered madly there. She beat at them wildly. Alan grabbed her and pulled her back. Through the eddying air of the living room, he could see a vast black cord of sparrows flowing up the stairs, up toward the office. 4. Stark reached for Thad as the first birds began to thump into the secret door. Beyond the wall, Thad could hear the muffled thud of falling paperweights and the tinkle of breaking glass. Both twins were wailing now. Their cries rose, blended with the maddening cheeping of the sparrows, and the two of them together made a kind of hell's harmony.
"Stop it!" Stark yelled. "Stop it, Thad! Whatever the hell you're doing, just stop it!"
He snatched for the gun, and Thad buried the pencil he had been holding in Stark's throat. Blood poured out in a rush. Stark turned toward him, gagging, clawing at the pencil. It bobbed up and down as he tried to swallow. He got one hand around it and pulled it out.
"What are you doing?" he croaked. "What is it?"
He heard the birds now. He did not understand them, but he heard them. His eyes rolled toward the closed door, and Thad saw real terror in those eyes for the first time.
"I'm writing the end, George," Thad said in a low voice neither Liz nor Alan heard downstairs. "I'm writing the end in the real world." "All right," Stark said. "Let's write it for all of us, then."
He turned toward the twins with the bloody pencil in one hand and the 45 in the other. 5. There was a folded afghan on the end of the sofa. Alan reached up for it, and what felt like a dozen hot sewing needles jabbed at his hand.
"Damn!" he yelled and pulled the hand back.
Liz was still trying to squirm out from under him. The monstrous whirring sound seemed to fill the whole universe now, and Alan could no longer hear the babies. But Liz Beaumont could. She wriggled and twisted and pulled. Alan fastened his left hand in her collar and felt the fabric rip.
"Wait a minute!"
he bellowed at her, but it was useless. There was nothing he could say to stop her while her children were screaming. Annie would have been the same. Alan reached up with his right hand again, ignoring the stabbing beaks this time, and snagged the afghan. It opened in tangled folds as it fell from the couch. From the master bedroom there was a tremendous crash as some piece of furniture, the bureau perhaps, fell over. Alan's distracted, overburdened mind tried to imagine how many sparrows it would take to tip over a bureau, and could not. "How many sparrows does it take to screw in a light bulb?" his mind asked crazily. 3 to hold the bulb and 3 billion to turn the house." He yodeled crazy laughter, and then the big hanging globe in the center of the living room exploded like a bomb. Liz screamed and cringed back for a moment, and Alan was able to throw the afghan over her head. He got under it himself. They weren't alone, even beneath it. Half a dozen sparrows were in there with them. He felt feathery wings flutter against his cheek, felt bright pain tattoo his left temple, and socked himself through the afghan. The sparrow tumbled to his shoulder and fell from beneath the blanket onto the floor. He yanked Liz against him and shouted into her ear,
"We're going to walk! Walk, Liz! Under this blanket! If you try to run, I'll knock you out! Nod your head if you understand!"
She tried to pull away. The afghan stretched. Sparrows landed briefly, bounced on it as if it were a trampoline, then flew again. Alan pulled her back against him and shook her by the shoulder, shook her hard.
"Nod if you understand, goddammit!"
He felt her hair tickle his cheek as she nodded. They crawled out from beneath the sofa. Alan kept his arm tightly around her shoulders, afraid she would bolt. And slowly they began to move across the swarming room, through the light maddening clouds of crying birds. They looked like a joke animal in a county fair, a dancing donkey with Mike as the head and Ike as the hindquarters. The living room of the Beaumont house was spacious, with a high cathedral ceiling, but now there seemed to be no air left. They walked through a yielding, shifting, gluey atmosphere of birds. Furniture crashed. Birds thudded off walls, ceilings, and appliances. The whole world had become bird stink and strange percussion. At last they reached the stairs and began to sway slowly up them beneath the Afghan, which was already coated with feathers and bird shit. And as they started to climb, a pistol shot crashed in the study upstairs. Now Alan could hear the twins again. They were shrieking. 6. Thad groped on the desk as Stark aimed the gun at William and came up with the paperweight Stark had been playing with. It was a heavy chunk of gray-black slate, flat on one side. He brought it down on Stark's wrist an instant before the big blonde man fired, breaking the bone and driving the barrel of the gun downward. The crash was deafening in the small room. The bullet plowed into the floor an inch from William's left foot, kicking splinters onto the legs of his fuzzy blue sleep suit. The twins began to shriek, and as Thad closed with Stark, he saw them put their arms around each other in a gesture of spontaneous mutual protection. Hansel and Gretel, he thought, and then Stark drove the pencil into his shoulder. Thad yelled with pain and shoved Stark away. Stark tripped over the typewriter which had been placed in the corner and fell backward against the wall. He tried to switch the pistol over to his right hand and dropped it. Now the sound of the birds against the door was a steady thunder, and it began to slip slowly open on its central pivot. A sparrow with a crushed wing oozed in and fell, twitching, on the floor. Stark felt in his back pocket and brought out the straight razor. He pulled the blade open with his teeth. His eyes sparkled crazily above the steel. "You on it, hoss?" he asked, and Thad saw the decay falling into his face again, coming all at once like a dropped load of bricks. "You really do? Okay, you got it." 7. Halfway up the stairs, Liz and Alan were stopped. They ran into a yielding, suspended wall of birds and simply could make no progress against it. The air fluttered and hummed with sparrows. Liz shrieked in terror and fury. The birds did not turn on them, did not attack them. They just thwarted them. All the sparrows in the world, it seemed, had been drawn here, to the second story of the Beaumont house in Castle Rock. "Down!" Alan shouted at her. "Maybe we can crawl under them!" They dropped to their knees. Progress was possible at first, although not pleasant. They found themselves crawling over a crunching, bleeding carpet of sparrows at least 18 inches deep. Then they ran into that wall again. Looking under the hem of the Afghan, Alan could see a crowded, confused mass that beggared description. The sparrows on the stair risers were being crushed. Layers and layers of the living, but soon to be dead, stood on top of them. Farther up, perhaps 3 feet off the stairs, sparrows flew in a kind of suicide traffic zone, colliding and falling, some rising and flying again, others squirming in the masses of their fallen mates with broken legs or wings. Sparrows, Alan remembered, could not hover. From somewhere above them, on the other side of this grotesque living barrier, a man screamed. Liz seized him, pulled him close.
"What can we do?" she screamed. "What can we do, Alan?"
He didn't answer her, because the answer was nothing. There was nothing they could do. 8. Stark came toward Thad with the razor in his right hand. Thad backed toward the slowly moving study door with his eyes on the blade. He snatched up another pencil from the desk.
"That ain't gonna do you no good, hoss," Stark said. "Not now."
Then his eyes shifted to the door. It had opened wide enough, and the sparrows flowed in, a river of them, and they flowed at George Stark. In an instant, his expression became one of horror and understanding.
"No!" he screamed, and began to slash at them with Alexis Machine's straight razor. "No, I won't! I won't go back! You can't make me!"
He cut one of the sparrows cleanly in half. It fell out of the air in 2 fluttering pieces. Stark ripped and flailed at the air around him. And Thad suddenly understood.
"I won't go back!"
What was happening here? The psychopomps, of course, had come to serve as George Stark's escort. George Stark's escort back to Ennsville, back to the land of the dead. Thad dropped the pencil and retreated toward his children. The air was filled with sparrows. The door had opened almost all the way now. The river had become a flood. Sparrows settled on Stark's broad shoulders. They settled on his arms, on his head. Sparrows struck his chest, dozens of them at first, then hundreds. He twisted this way and that in a cloud of falling feathers and flashing, slashing beaks, trying to give back what he was getting. They covered the straight razor. Its evil silver gleam was gone, buried beneath the feathers that were stuck to it. Thad looked at his children. They had stopped weeping. They were looking up into the stuffed boiling air with identical expressions of wonder and delight. Their hands were raised, as if to check for rain. Their tiny fingers were outstretched. Sparrows stood on them and did not peck. But they were pecking Stark. Blood burst from his face in 100 places. One of his blue eyes winked out. A sparrow landed on the collar of his shirt and sent his beak diving into the hole Thad had made with the pencil in Stark's throat. The bird did it 3 times, fast, rat-tat-tat, like a machine gun, before Stark's groping hand seized it and crushed it like a piece of living origami. Thad crouched by the twins, and now the birds lit on him as well, not pecking, just standing, and watching. Stark had disappeared. He had become a living, squirming bird sculpture. Blood oozed through the jostling wings and feathers. From somewhere below, Thad heard a shrieking, splintering sound, wood giving way. They have broken their way into the kitchen, he thought. He thought briefly of the gas lines that fed the stove, but the thought was distant, unimportant. And now he began to hear the loose, wet plop and smack of the living flesh being torn off George Stark's bones. They've come for you, George, he heard himself whisper. They've come for you. God help you now. 9. Alan sensed space above him again and looked up through the diamond-shaped holes in the afghan. Bird shit dripped onto his cheek, and he wiped it away. The stairwell was still full of birds, but their numbers had thinned. Most of those still alive had apparently gotten where they were going. Come on, he said to Liz, and they began to move up over the ghastly carpet of dead birds again. They had managed to gain the second-floor landing when they heard Thad shriek, Take him, then! Take him! Take him back to hell where he belongs! And the whirring of the birds became a hurricane. 10. Stark made one last galvanic effort to get away from them. There was nowhere to go, nowhere to run, but he tried anyway. It was his style. The column of birds which had covered him moved forward with him. Gigantic puffy arms covered with feathers and heads and wings rose, beat themselves across his torso, rose again and crossed themselves at the chest. Birds, some wounded, some dead, fell to the floor, and for one moment Thad was afforded a vision which would haunt him for the rest of his life. The sparrows were eating George Stark alive. His eyes were gone. Where they had been, only vast dark sockets remained. His nose had been reduced to a bleeding flap. His forehead and most of his hair had been struck away, revealing the mucus-bleared surface of his skull. The collar of his shirt still ringed his neck, but the rest was gone. Ribs poked out of his skin in white lumps. The birds had opened his belly. A drove of sparrows sat on his feet and looked up with bright attention and squabbled for his guts as they fell out in dripping, shredded chunks. And he saw something else. The sparrows were trying to lift him up. They were trying. And very soon, when they had reduced his body weight enough, they would do just that. Take him, then, he screamed. Take him! Take him back to hell where he belongs! Stark's screams stopped as his throat disintegrated beneath 100 hammering, dipping beaks. Sparrows clustered under his armpits, and for a second his feet rose from the bloody carpet. He brought his arms, what remained of them, down into his sides in a savage gesture, crushing dozens. But dozens upon dozens more came to take their places. The sound of pecking and splintering wood to Thad's right suddenly grew louder, hollower. He looked in that direction and saw the wood of the study's east wall disintegrating like tissue paper. For an instant he saw 1,000 yellow beaks burst through at once, and then he grabbed the twins and rolled over them, arching his body to protect them, moving with real grace for perhaps the only time in his life. The wall crashed inward in a dusty cloud of splinters and sawdust. Thad closed his eyes and hugged his children close to him. He saw no more. 11. But Alan Pangborn did, and Liz did too. They had pulled the Afghan down to their shoulders as the cloud of birds over them and around them shredded apart. Liz began to stumble into the guest bedroom toward the open study door, and Alan followed her. For a moment he couldn't see into the study. It was only a cloudy brown-black blur. And then he made out a shape, a horrible, padded shape. It was Stark. He was covered with birds, eaten alive, and yet he still lived. More birds came, more still. Alan thought their horrid shrill cheeping would drive him mad. And then he saw what they were doing.
"Alan!" Liz screamed. "Alan, they're lifting him!"
The thing which had been George Stark, a thing which was now only vaguely human, rose into the air on a cushion of sparrows. It moved across the office, almost fell, then rose unsteadily once more. It approached the huge, splinter-ringed hole in the east wall. More birds flew in through this hole. Those which still remained in the guest room rushed into the study. Flesh fell from Stark's twitching skeleton in a grisly rain. The body floated through the hole with sparrows flying around it and tearing out the last of its hair. Alan and Liz struggled over the rug of dead birds and into the study. Thad was rising slowly to his feet, a weeping twin in each arm. Liz ran to them and took them from him. Her hands flew over them, looking for wounds.
"Okay," Thad said. "I think they're okay."
Alan went to the ragged hole in the study wall. He looked out and saw a scene from some malign fairy tale. The sky was black with birds, and yet in one place it was ebony, as if a hole had been torn in the fabric of reality. This black hole bore the unmistakable shape of a struggling man. The birds lifted it higher, higher, higher. It reached the tops of the trees and seemed to pause there. Alan thought he heard a high-pitched, inhuman scream from the center of that cloud. Then the sparrows began to move again. In a way, watching them was like watching a film run backward. Black streams of sparrows boiled from all the shattered windows in the house. They funneled upward from the driveway, the trees, and the curved roof of Raleigh's Volkswagen. They all moved toward that central darkness. That man-shaped patch began to move again, over the trees, into the dark sky. And there it was lost to view. Liz was sitting in the corner, the twins in her lap, rocking them, comforting them. But neither of them seemed particularly upset any longer. They were looking cheerily up into her haggard, tear-stained face. Wendy patted it, as if to comfort her mother. William reached up, plucked a feather from her hair, and examined it closely.
"He's gone," Thad said hoarsely.
He had joined Alan at the hole in the study wall.
"Yes," Alan said.
He suddenly burst into tears. He had no idea that was coming. It just happened. Thad tried to put his arms around him, and Alan stepped away, his boots crunching dryly in drifts of dead sparrows.
"No," he said, "I'll be all right."
Thad was looking out through the ragged hole again, into the night. A sparrow came out of that dark and landed on his shoulder.
"Thank you," Thad said to it.
The sparrow pecked him, suddenly and viciously, bringing blood just below his eye. Then it flew away to join its mates.
"Why?"
Liz asked. She was looking at Thad in shocked wonder.
"Why did it do that?"
Thad did not respond, but he thought he knew the answer. He thought Raleigh de Lesseps would have known, too. What had just happened was magical enough, but it had been no fairy tale. Perhaps the last sparrow had been moved by some force which felt Thad needed to be reminded of that, forcibly reminded. "Be careful, Thaddeus. No man controls the agents of the afterlife, not for long, and there is always a price." "What price will I have to pay?" he wondered coldly. Then, "And the bill, when does it come due?" But that was a question for another time, another day. And there was this. Perhaps the bill had been paid. Perhaps he was finally even.
"Is he dead?"
Liz was asking, almost begging. "Yes," Thad said. "He's dead, Liz. Third time's the charm. The book is closed on George Stark. Come on, you guys. Let's get out of here." And that was what they did.